Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated majority to save our democracy before it's stolen next November, tune in Mondays to Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your background briefing here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Mark your calendars. KPFK Summer Fun Drive officially kicks off on Tuesday, July 21st. We want to keep this drive as short as possible and get right back to the uninterrupted, commercial-free programming you love. But we can only do that with your immediate support. Shorten the drive today. Call 818-985-5735 and press option 2. That's 818-985-5735, option 2. Or skip the phone lines and give securely online right now at kpfk.org/donate. Your radio station, your voice. Keep it strong. Thank you.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFK, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara.
Hello, and this is Alan Minsky live at KPFK Radio. And it is, of course, the day of the Men's World Cup Soccer Tournament Final. It is also a day when I can now report to you that 40,000 red cards are being distributed to attendees of the game. Hopefully those other 40,000 people in the stadium will have their own ad hoc red cards, because when Donald Trump goes onto center stage to give out the trophy of the World Cup, it is time to go into your pocket, grab a red card, boo-boo with every bit of energy you have left in your lungs, and raise that red card to the sky and show it to Donald Trump. He took center stage and dominated the stage at last year's Men's Club World Cup Championship. Absolute narcissistic disgrace. The players are like, what the heck is this guy doing here? He wants to be center stage, and we should show him what his role in international football is. You have a red card for life. Get the heck out of here, man. You've corrupted this tournament. You interfered as you're never supposed to do. There's supposed to be an iron wall between political authority and the games on the field. He corrupted that every bit as bad as the Black Sox scandal back in 1919. Just like Trump does with everything, he's corrupt, and he is driving our society down into spaces even worse than we've been for a long, long time. So that's happening today. And of course, there's a little soccer game going on with Spain and Argentina. Later on in the hour, we'll be talking with Melissa Figueroa, of course, our co-host and co-producer, about the ways in which Argentina has, I think, appropriately been vilified by the international left for the degree of racism on the team and in the club. And of course, Lamine Yamal, big champion of the Palestinian people. So, and Leo Messi, Saint Messi. Nobody believes he's really at the heart of this sort of vile racism that's expressed by Argentinian fans. But come on, man. He's got to say something about it, right? And he doesn't. So we'll talk about that. We'll hear from a quote from Ana Lilia Mejia, the congresswoman who's on site passing out those red cards. And we'll talk about that project called Final Red Card and the People's Game's relationship to it. And we might hear of another little clip, too, from a candidate from the Central Valley, Randy Villegas. But right now, we're going to go to an interview that Melissa and I did with the great soccer historian, former player, professor here in Southern California, Jules Boykoff. So let's go to that right now. And this is a fantastic dialogue recorded just the other day. And welcome back to the People's Game and Jacobin Radio. And we are now joined by really one of the most prominent progressive voices, certainly in the United States, but in the Anglophone world, commenting on global sports spectacle, and the World Cup. Appropriately, his latest book is called Red Card. And we are, of course, talking about Jules Boykoff, who is joining us right now. And Red Card is subtitled The 2026 World Cup, Sportsmanship, and the FIFA Greed Machine.
just out this year. And also, by the way, Kicking from Duke University Press, which is a memoir about his former life as a professional footballer and his current life as a critical academic of sport. And I have to say, you know, I've seen so many interviews with you, Jules Boykoff, and you're absolutely fantastic commentator. And, you know, it's funny because I think the fact that you're always introduced as a former footballer allows you probably a lot of people, okay, well, this guy's going to know that side of it too. And then I looked at your bibliography and all every single book that you've published, I want to read now. And there are a lot of them. You can check out his full bibliography over at Wikipedia. But Jules Boykoff did a lot of interviews around the top of the World Cup, understandably. And I'm sure many over recent days, I saw you on CNN when Donald Trump was able to intervene in the course of this World Cup and have Balogun's red card reversed by Infantino. But let's start at the top of the tournament and the expectations around this tournament. How have those been fulfilled? The sense that this was a World Cup that should never happen, the United States should never host it, a lot of anticipation that there'd be empty seats. And I think the sport of soccer, in spite of FIFA, in spite of Donald Trump, and boy, the crimes of Trump go beyond the red card, the treatment of the Iranian team, et cetera, people. And annual ticket prices and everything still corrupts this World Cup. But the spectacle on the field and the games on the field have been so riveting. So what's your overall assessment of this World Cup, and where does it leave global football right now in terms of FIFA and this being the signature sports event in the world?
Well, for me, it's been a split screen event in a pretty significant way. Just like you described, Alan, on one side of the screen, you've got incredible performances from places like Cape Verde, who, it should be said, did top their group in Africa during the qualifiers. So real soccer heads would know that they had a good team that they're bringing to this World Cup. But my goodness, almost upsetting Argentina, and with arguably one of the best goals in the tournament as well. That was fun. I have to say, we all knew that there was going to be fantastic football in this tournament. This shouldn't really come as a surprise. When you bring together most of the best players in the world, that's going to happen. And in a lot of ways, it's been a World Cup of inclusion in the sense that they included 48 teams rather than 32 as they did last time in Qatar. But there's no getting around the fact that under President Donald Trump, where a majority of the games were held in the United States, this has been a World Cup of exclusion. And, you know, I've been asked recently by journalists, oh, Trump really didn't do that much during this World Cup. Are you kind of surprised by that? And I'm thinking, what? Do you think he really laid low at this World Cup? Him and his administration were extraordinarily active. I mean, I think it shows how his actions in the past have really stretched out the expectations of the media and maybe everyday people as well, maybe even stretched out the expectations beyond recognition, because the Trump administration put a huge and ugly stamp on this World Cup in many ways that if another host did it, it would have been massive and an enduring scandal. I mean, what I'm talking about is like during the World Cup, Alan, ICE actually ramped up its violent deportation machine. It ramped it up. And like there was barely any corporate media coverage of this. It increased. Did it happen in the cities where the World Cup was happening? No, it didn't. It happened in places far from the global media who were visiting for the tournament. And so it's just remarkable for that. Also, based on exclusion, they banned a Somali referee, one of the best referees in the world, just won an award in Africa for being the best men's referee. And, you know, the world was jumping up and down saying, this is ridiculous, this is unfair. But I think you need to read Trump's interventions as him talking to his domestic base, because when him banning a Somali referee chimes perfectly with his horrific comments about Somali people being garbage and trash. And one last thing I'll just say about this is that also midstream during this tournament, Trump's Department of Homeland Security issued a number of just like straight up racist anti-immigration tweets that featured players from the U.S. team. In fact, one of the racist posts that they put on X said, and I'm going to quote it here for us, defend the homeland, one nation, one homeland, one team. And if that sounds to you like something a Nazi might write, it's because it is. I mean, the phrasing echoes the Nazi slogan, one people, one realm, one leader. And so it's actually, it has not been a surprise to me that Trump has been a big part of this World Cup. And it's not even over yet because he's going to make a grand appearance at the final. And goodness knows what's going to happen there.
Yeah, all of that is true. And also, I also want to add that ICE raids were going on in Kansas City as well. We spoke to Hartzell Gray, who was on the ground with folks defending immigrants against the raids that were happening as the game was going on, actually. But you say this is like a split screen. I want to sort of flip to the other side of it, which has been the experience among the people, the grassroots experience. You're thinking about Lawrence, Kansas, and how they welcomed the Algerian team, how, you know, we've been talking on this podcast about how even the Mexico's run, which was really exciting, brought a lot of immigrants out, back out into the streets in LA, where the unions had actually kept ICE away. Some people coming out onto the streets for the first time in months because they've been hiding because of the ICE raids. I'm also thinking about this this morning in terms of the U.S. as a declining hegemon in the world, and thinking about the question, what does it mean for us in the United States? Like, how do we learn to not be a hegemon, you know, just in terms of like our daily life and our relations with people around the world? And in some way, I feel like the expansion of the World Cup like may have been the one inadvertently good thing that Infantino did, because we can see, you know, Haiti in a different light than we see it in the media, right? We can see Cabo Verde in a different light than, you know, and we learn about countries that were not bombing or interfering with their governments, right? So I'm wondering about what the World Cup experience may also mean for us, and maybe if you have observed, if people may have learned anything from this experience about being one of many in a community of nations.
Yeah, so many great points that you just raised. And one that I want to pick up is the crucial importance of what we saw in places like Lawrence, Kansas, because this World Cup was always going to be an opportunity for everyday working people in the United States to show the rest of the world that we cannot be reduced, distilled down to this sort of cruel form of MAGA that is so pervasive, not only in the United States, but also in the media. It really amplifies that cruelty every day. And so people in the United States were able to say, look, welcome, please, open arms, come here. We want to learn from you. We want to make sure that you're safe while you're here and have a lot of fun. And it was Lawrence, it was other places around the country. I think it's especially important in this moment. You know, the World Cup is a great chance to think about the decline of the United States in a lot of ways. In fact, you know, the United States not doing all that well in this tournament. I mean, they went about as far as most people thought they would, but the fact of the matter is the United States is simply not a soccer power. And in a lot of ways, it comes down to the fact that the soccer is organized in a way in the United States that advantages those who have money, that are rich. I mean, the competitive soccer system in the United States is nothing less than a class project. And so I think probably if people are going to start searching for answers, at least when we're talking on the men's side, of course, the women's team is brilliant and successful and has been for a long time and will be for a long time into the future. But that's a different story. But I think if they're going to have a conversation about what it means to be a declining hegemon, a really nice way of framing it up for people would be, why is the United States so bad? And why will they probably not get better in the future because they're so stuck in their ways?
There's so much to say on all of this. And so many different questions for Jules Boykoff. I mean, there are so many things. How did you look at the defeat of the United States in Belgium and its relationship to Trump's intervention? And, you know, what level, you know, a few days out now, do you view that in the sins of the corruption of sports going back to the 1919 Black Sox scandal? I mean, where does it fit? I mean, it's appalling that it happened. I also thought, by the way, the treatment of the Iranian team was absolutely just undercutting their capacity to compete. Imagine if you did that to one of the top teams, their soccer federations would be in uproar and their fan bases all around the world would be in an uproar. And that's all because of Trump. And I think it sets a terrible standard for sports in general going forward. As you know, the reason we love this is because unlike reality in life, it's a level playing field. And this seemed pretty interfered with in this one. So what are your thoughts on that front?
Well, the rescinded red card for U.S. forward Follorin Balogun will go down, I'm quite confident, as one of the most significant corrupt interventions in the history of the World Cup. there really just isn't a precedent for it. And it points up the cozy relationship that Trump has long had with the head of FIFA, Gianni Infantino. And it really put the United States in a difficult position. Fuller and Balogun ended up playing. He had an okay game, but no matter what happened, there was always going to be an asterisk attached to the performance. If he played and would have scored and the U.S. would have somehow managed to beat Belgium that night, everyone would have said it was just because of the intervention. And if they didn't play as well as people had hoped, and they definitely didn't, there was going to be an asterisk that it was because they were distracted by what was happening with President Trump. And, you know, Fowler and Balogun went on CBS television and said as much. Mm-hmm. He said that he did think the team was distracted by what happened with the red card. And so actually Trump did hurt the chances of the U.S. team. And on top of that, it gave the opportunity for Belgium to troll the United States. And they did not miss the opportunity. As your listeners may have seen, they not only did a sort of fake Trump dance on the field, but they also did it in the locker room to the tune of the YMCA. So they absolutely made fun of President Trump. And so it was just like an all around debacle. And it doesn't, the last thing I'll just say is that just as the Trump administration and its MAGA right-wing ecosystem has worked hard to destabilize the very notion of truth in the public sphere, what we saw with the Balogun red card is the destabilization of fairness in sport. Mm-hmm. And when FIFA loses that, they're in serious trouble.
Right.
Absolutely. And I want to maybe get some elaboration on that a little bit because, you know, after the red card incident, then everything started to turn to, again, the corruption, and especially after the Egypt-Argentina game, and then all of the theories, the conspiracy that have propped up around Argentina, which is now in the final, which to me has like sort of two valences to it. One is sort of unfair to the Argentina team who has, you know, who has played well. I don't know, but
oh, they should be getting. Also, I think they should. I actually, to just add into the question, I think they should be getting much more grief for their racism than they are.
And
I think,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think they're protected.
Absolutely.
By, they're protected by Saint Messi, who also right. called out for
who took a picture with Netanyahu. So there you go. But all this to say is, like, you know, it colors how we view the play on the field, and also. And also, which I think is far more interesting politically, is that now FIFA and Infantino have become this lightning rod, this flashpoint for global anger against corruption in general. And so, yeah, I'm wondering to hear your thoughts on that, your thoughts on Argentina, and how you think this might sort of play into this interplay between real world politics and the politics of sport.
Yeah, well, first of all, this tournament has been a boon for the tinfoil hat industry, if you will. I mean, conspiracy theories left and right everywhere you look now, and they're getting all sorts of traction. And you're right, a lot of it is just because of things that FIFA has done or some of the decisions that we've seen on the field, the use of VAR, which a lot of soccer purists really don't like. And that does really put the integrity of sport in a different sort of place. And I think a lot of scales have fallen from a lot of eyes over the course of this tournament, from when FIFA and Gianni Infantino handed a peace prize to President Trump back in 2025, to all the way through the decision around the red card, to the way Argentina has been able to gallop kind of through this tournament with a whole host of calls to his advantage. And I think that is actually given rise to a really interesting campaign that I'd love to sort of mention if I could. And I'm also in full disclosure, part of it on the advisory board of this group called Fair Square. It's a human rights group based in London. And we have a campaign called Reboot FIFA. You can go to rebootfifa.com. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to actually regulate FIFA, not through their own ethics committee. Yes, folks, they actually have an ethics committee, believe it or not. But through the European Parliament and other governing bodies, including we're taking this to Congress in the United States for those that are interested. And we're trying to say, look, FIFA is incapable of governing itself. It needs more transparency. It needs people outside of FIFA governing it. And also, you know, we just think it's time for Gianni Infantino to move on. He's made millions of dollars for himself. He just got a raise up to $6 million. If you're on the FIFA Council, the 36 people that are the most powerful group in FIFA, you attend 2 to 4 meetings a year and you make $250,000 to $300,000 a year. That system of patronage and basically selling off the integrity of football needs to stop. So am I saying it's going to be easy? Absolutely not. But there are people that are rallying around the sport of soccer or football around the world because they love it. And they want it to be better for the players, for the fans, for everybody involved in the sport. So if you do want to check it out at rebootfifa.com, you can sign your name on, because what we're trying to do is create the biggest ever class action complaint against FIFA. So anybody can be a part of it who's disgusted by FIFA and is on sides with all the things that we've been talking about today.
Well, thank you so much. And this interview is going to air on Pacifica Radio 2 hours before the kickoff for the men's final, and it is going to air on Jacobin Radio Podcast a couple days after. So be cautious as to what you say, because probably the largest portion of the audience will hear what you're about to say after the results. Who do you think is going to take this game between Argentina and Spain?
Oh my gosh, that is a difficult question, but I'm going to go with Spain based on the team that they have. They are a legitimate team and they have so many great weapons off the bench that I'm going to go with Spain in this instance. They've been an absolute machine from just about the beginning of the tournament, almost, when they did have one tie at the outset against a very good team, Cape Verde. But yeah, I'm going to go with Spain on this one. How about you?
Yeah, I am too, with the stipulation that they, of course, sort of need to score the first goal. I don't have that much confidence in them to come back if Argentina scores first. I'm confident they will score first. And I'm hoping that Nico Williams can play a few more minutes. You know, they've gotten this far with a sort of hobbled team, but the midfield is spectacular at controlling the ball. Another question for, obviously, this is an Anglophone podcast. We're speaking English. How much blame do you put on Thomas Tuchel for what did seem to be one of the greatest capitulations I've ever seen in any sporting event, just on the field? 88-12 was the distribution of ball control after Gordon scored the goal to put them ahead of Argentina. And had they even tried to attack Argentina going forward, they ended up with two central defenders on yellow cards. They pulled a holding midfielder. They were right to have England score more goals against them. What did you make of that? And do you hold Tuchel responsible?
Yeah, I mean, for the listeners that weren't following it as closely as we were, basically Thomas Tuchel, the coach of England, took off some offensive players, replaced them with highly defensive players, went into a shell, and then got shelled and lost 2-1.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's basically what happened. And, you know, I totally agree that it was a little bit too early to go into that defensive shell. On the other hand, it kind of worked in previous matches. And if it would have worked in this instance, most people wouldn't be having the conversation. So I think that it was a strategy. He went all in for it. He's known for being kind of a guy who likes to put his strategies at the center of play instead of reading the moment and seeing what's right. And I think he paid the price for that. I mean, I think football is dominated by enormous egos, and Thomas Tuchel is one of those people that has an enormous ego. And sometimes that helps with your decisions, and you make confident decisions that turn out right, and sometimes they're wrong. And this was totally wrong, I think. But I have no problem with England leaving the tournament. Now I'm going to get a bunch of hate mail, of course, but I have no problem with them not bringing it home, if you will. this is going to be discussed ad nauseum all the way until the next World Cup, probably. But it was certainly a miscalculation, but had it gone right, we wouldn't be talking about it.
So one of the things I thought was an interesting sort of new phenomenon specific to this World Cup was Tuchel for England. Of course, they once had Fabio Cavallo, Carlo Ancelotti for Brazil, and a Pochettino for the U.S. men's team. I think of the three, Pochettino comes out best, but look at the two coaches in the finalists. Do you think, having watched global football your entire life, that in fact these elite club coaches are actually mismatches for the tournament national team soccer competitions? And in fact, someone coming out of the core of the project actually works better, because it certainly seems to.
That's a really interesting question. I do think, first of all, it reflects the intensification of the sport's internationalization. I mean, with globalization, we've seen basically extractivist soccer culture at work, meaning you have mostly Western Europe extracting the best talent, the best coaches from the rest of the world. And I don't know necessarily if they're, I don't think it's a problem to have a coach from another country. I think they can connect with the players. It can actually be a positive thing to have somebody from outside, especially somebody who's gone through some things before and has a positive reputation, because most of these teams are chock full of players that have, let's just say, healthy egos. And yeah. A lot of it is less about managing tactics and strategy and as it is managing egos. And if you have somebody who comes from afar, who has a storied record as a coach, it can help keep the egos in check. And that can actually be one of those locker room things that can play out on the field that a lot of people don't necessarily think of. So I don't know. I don't think there's any problem of having a coach from afar with a good record. At the same time, this is always going to be a conversation, especially because it also links to, can the United States really truly build up a proper soccer culture in this country on the men's side of the ball? And having coaches from the United States could be a big part of that.
I know you got to go and we only got a second left here, but you know, the Infantino stepladder model of organizing FIFA around the confederations with multiple members, therefore they get elected to their positions, I believe doesn't help South America, does help Europe, though relatively not as much as its power in the capitalized game. It helps Africa with all the nations. It doesn't help Asia. And it doesn't help the two largest countries in the world. Believe it or not, this sport has a potential tremendous growth upside. The sport in India and China, do you think we'll see them in a World Cup anytime soon? Will it take going to 64 teams or more? And can you imagine a World Cup that's even bigger than what it is now? It could double the audience just from the inclusion of those two countries. And your thoughts on that? Because that's always a mystery in global football. And can reboot FIFA help for a reorganization so that where the most of the people are in the world, not the number of countries, can maybe rebalance in terms of how FIFA is configured?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm speaking for myself now, not the Reboot FIFA campaign, but I think the expansion to 64 teams is an absolute nightmare in the sense that it is a sporty carbon bomb in action. This was already the most destructive in terms of environmental elements, the most destructive tournament in the history of the World Cup. With 48 teams. If you go to 64 teams, then you have even more teams flying and traveling. You might have to build more stadiums. It is just going the absolute wrong direction on a tournament where it has been very much affected by climate change in the sense that the final might even be postponed because of the smoke in New York. We've had the introduction of hydration breaks. I know probably a lot of your listeners would prefer to call them commercial breaks, and they're right. But, you know, they're also, it comes out of a real concern for athlete health. And so I think this notion of expanding the tournament to 64 is problematic on many fronts. Yeah. But you're absolutely right that there is still tremendous growth potential for FIFA. They're looking at China. They're looking at India, like you mentioned, where in India now, a lot of more sort of upper class people are playing soccer and moving away from cricket as sort of a status symbol. The other place that they can still have a lot of growth is Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And so that is probably behind the scenes why FIFA is interested in expanding to a larger tournament, because you can start to possibly fold in those three countries, India, China, and Indonesia, and thereby boost your marketing and also then be able to charge more for the broadcasting. And just last point on this, with the hydration breaks / commercial breaks, obviously, that's been a boon for the broadcasters because they can charge a lot, especially U.S. broadcasters could charge a ton for the commercials during U.S. matches. But FIFA will tell us, oh, we didn't make anything off of that. And I guess that's sort of true, but they will make money off of that the next time they negotiate a broadcast contract, because I don't think in an age of climate change, these hydration breaks are going away anytime soon at the Men's World Cup. And so they'll be able to go to these broadcasters as they negotiate the next contract and say, hey, you have extra opportunity for running commercials during this World Cup. Therefore, you need to pay us more. So FIFA ultimately will benefit from this. And it's extra galling because FIFA talks a big game when it comes to climate change, but they do close to nothing to actually helping it. So not only are they greenwashing to the extreme, but now they're benefiting economically from the greenwashing that they're doing.
I'm sorry for this, Jules. I got one final thing. The New York Knicks won the NBA title. Zohran Mamdani, the mayor of New York, seemed to be part of the very fabric of this incredible celebration that happened, and somewhat under his guidance, and with Donald Trump showing up on the one day, of course, they would lose. this was a celebration that seemed to cross-fertilize with left progressive politics. Your thoughts about sports in a more democratic society we hope to build, and sense of solidarity, international solidarity, the capacity of sports still at this hour to produce that, as opposed to huger carbon footprints, massive commercialization, and ticket prices that only the oligarchs can afford effectively. What's your thoughts on that? Because I thought New York City showed that this is still in this country, and really could be anywhere, that this could be a force for real positive, bringing together of people where they can have a glimmer of a different and a better world.
We're living in a really interesting moment where we have two prominent leaders in the United States, in Zoran Mamdani and Donald Trump, who are sort of testing this theory that you can be more politically effective by being less explicitly political. Both of them have embraced sports in different ways to their political advantage, but each of them have totally different visions about what sports is and can be in terms of bringing people together. And I just was in New York a few days ago, where Zoran Mamdani has opened up the soccer fields to play all night long, where he managed to somehow squeegee away 1,000 tickets for people to attend the World Cup at reasonable prices, working people to attend the World Cup final at reasonable prices of $50. And he's constantly talking about sports. It helps the fact that he's an actual soccer fan. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, that speech that he gave at the New York Knicks rally after they won the NBA championship, what a beautiful piece of oratory. So he is very much using sports in a way to think about politics afresh. On the flip side, we've got Donald Trump at this exact same moment using sports for sort of personal advancement, for lining his own pockets, for hanging out with the world's elites, for creating this sort of privileged sliver of the global 1% that is going to rule everything. And I think with those two visions, almost diametrically opposed, yet connected by sport, it shows that we actually do have a choice in the matter. And it's my hope, and I'm certain yours, that more people, as we think further toward the next World Cup, the Women's World Cup in Brazil that's coming up, that we'll be able to think more internationally and use sports more for the Zoran Mamdani vision of what it can do for us, and certainly not what President Trump has in mind.
We were very happy that when he put out his first video critiquing FIFA, he referred to the sport of soccer as the people's game. So thank you, as always, Jules Boykoff. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your career work, your incredible books, and your interventions in the moment. Again, people, check out Reboot FIFA online, and check out Jules Boykoff's book, the most recent of, well, two came out this year. One is a memoir called Kicking from Duke University Press, and the other is Red Card, about the 2026 World Cup. Jules Boykoff, thank you so much, and talk to you soon.
Thank you, Alan. It was a pleasure.
Man, and that guy's incredible, man. And, there's so many great soccer commentators out there across the world. And the question I asked him about, the left and the promise of sports and sports celebrations for the left, and the relationship of, the left and progressivism, left radicalism, even liberalism, left liberalism, to sports, I think I actually left out the key worrying component, of course, of global sports culture. Well, I think actually financialization and the cost of it would be probably equal to this, is, of course, classical bravado patriarchy. And in the next little rest of the show today, we're going to interweave a dialogue between myself and my co-host, who's joining me now, Melissa Figueroa, about the Argentinian national team, the critique that they now, I think appropriately, has been leveled against them. But, a lot of it does have to do with the machismo and racism aspect of associated with the Argentinian football culture. Of course, that cross-fertilizes with Argentinian social history, but also the attitude, of course, of that bravado and patriarchal dominant sort of culture that we all know about, crass sexist culture associated with sports cultures. If you're to channel what the response was, you can sort of see someone like Enzo Fernandez just looking you dead in the eye and saying, like, I don't know, it would be insulting the language he'd probably use, but like, oh, we'd crush you. We just crush you. This is the male orbit. And that's something that the left also has to contend with, is that very toxic masculine culture that pervades sports culture in the United States and around the world, and how that's overcome. And you know, by the way, you know, there's even like Breonna Joy Gray. I saw had a one of her podcast shows this week about, you know, hey, it's all right to love men and love men for their strength and all this stuff, right? You know, so anyway, of course, you know, that if that's a part of men, it's part of women too. But, you know, how do you contend with that? Well, you don't contend with it by fascist racism, misogyny. You know, maybe you contend with it by just channeling it into, you know, being a good soccer defender, but not being absolute pig-headed jerk. I can use a much stronger word than that. Mel, your thoughts on all that?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I was actually just reading a really interesting Facebook post by someone who, there's two actually really interesting articles. One is in The Independent, I think it was yesterday, by a Bengali author who actually talked about the meaning of the World Cup and Maradona's Argentina to people in South Asia, which was also fascinating. And then also at the same time, the article was titled, I Won't Cry For You, Argentina, in which he really described the process of heartbreak for people who have been Argentina fans for so long, and now seeing kind of the way that it's become this, kind of recipient of the oligarchic favor and patronage. So I really recommend that. And another article on Facebook was kind of talking about it the same way. There was another tweet that said, you know, this is probably the first colonizer versus colonized game in the World Cup when people are going to say, well, there's a lot of nuances to that.
Yeah, I see.
You know, given, of course, Argentina's history as a genocidal settler colonialist nation, much like the one we're in right now. And, you know, and it was different in Maradona's time, I think, because, you know, Maradona was very visibly indigenous and very much kind of featured that both in his play and in his political outspokenness. You know, of course, Messi, he's more machine now than man, as I like to say, where, you know, I mean, of course, he's such a gifted player in the same way that Maradona is, but he is not you know, of that social strata, and hasn't not been for a long time. And, you know, he kind of like does what everybody asks of him, including taking pictures with Netanyahu. There are also the kind of alignment of the Argentina fans, which I think is especially ugly, in this tournament under Malay, with them, you know, waving Israeli flags and the face of Muslim players and all of that. But going back to, you know, again, the era of Maradona that, you know, those of us who have rooted for the Albiceleste in the past have kind of
think back
nostalgically to.
Preach it, sister.
In terms of the patriarchy, I think that was still very much present, especially, you know, I mean, like, we loved Maradona when he was kind of like our a-hole, you know, but that kind of the patriarchalness, I think is consistent, from then till now, which, as you point out, has also consistently been a problem, for the left of, you know, even the patriarchy and the best of movements in the 1960s and 1970s, you know, was a reflection of that. So, you know, I see that, across Gaza, they're waving Spanish flags.
Sure. They would be, yeah.
You know, yeah. And interestingly enough, Spain's, playing style and also, comments by the coach ahead of the game where he acknowledged the Argentinian use of the dark arts, right, and lamented the referee's proclivities to allow that to happen. But he also did say, you know, that makes it much more important for the Spanish team to keep its cool, to be, you know, the onus of professionalism and in some ways a counterweight to the, you know, the aggressive, macho style of the Argentinians. So, you know, knowing that they're very aware of that going into this match, I absolutely think that it's going to be a very, very interesting matchup to see in terms of the way that, you know, each team has kind of committed to presenting themselves.
Well, there's okay. And in a second, we're going to do a clip from actually somebody who's been a familiar voice on KPFK's airwaves, George Galloway. In a moment, we're going to be a couple minutes. I got a couple of things to say following for what you said, and also talk a little bit about the game on the field and Leo Messi and Diego Maradona. For soccer heads, I think I'm going to throw out some pretty interesting and things that people like to chew on for a while. But Galloway, when we go to him, I just want to be clear. You know, he's a controversial figure and all, but what he says here is, I think, very. It's a lot of things to think about from what he says. He does, however, have quite a history of saying, I have this information in this document that's going to blow your mind, and then it never appears and he never produces it. So take with a grain of salt what he says on that front, certainly. But nevertheless, I think he hit some important points on the head. Might as well play it. This is just also as an expression of what has really become quite a a chorus of condemnation of the Argentinians in Argentinian culture. And by the way, it doesn't even extend beyond Malay and stuff. You know, there was, again, a very prominent black influencer who was wearing an Argentinian shirt, and the response of some of the, you know, in person at the game Argentinian fans to even just awareness of the picture or his presence wearing it was some of the most vile, direct expressed racism I've seen in a while, because, you know, mainly racists, you know, slink away in shame when they're in public confronting people. This was really vile. That's a big part of this team's culture. And I understand there are a lot of people out there. I've spoken to them today, friends, great comrades who are rooting for Argentina because they've been attached to Messi. And there's been this whole trajectory of his career. And we have to only go back just really 6 years ago. And the thing was, and this goes to the first point about soccer on the field in Spain versus Argentina, that, you know, Messi was great. He was incredible. He could dribble. He was a phenomenal record, but he was winning with his club team because it was Barcelona. He came out of the system. You took him out of the system, and the critique was he wasn't as great. And really, there was a period about 6 years ago where I think his stature, because of that critique, as great as the results were in Barcelona. But here's the thing. He knows tiki-taka. He's going to see it today. And that's another interesting component, as opposed to the French players who, you know, they were just overwhelmed by the Spanish ball control. Assuming Messi's mind is into how they're going to approach the game, he knows what the Spanish do like nothing. And I'll finish the thought on Merida and Massini in a second, but your thoughts, Mel, and then back to me, then to Galloway. Your thoughts, Mel.
Absolutely. I think that this is why the matchup today between Messi and Yamal is going to be incredibly interesting to watch. Yamal coming out of the same system, but he's sort of part of the new generation coming in, and, you know, we have this kind of generational matchup. So, you know, if anything could give him a run for the money, it could be Yamal. It could be Unai Simón, you know. You know, one of the things I was thinking about, and as somebody who has been a Messi fan for so long, and, you know, even in the group stages, seeing those flashes of brilliance that I haven't seen for quite some time, you know, as since the transition that you talked about. Like I said, I think it just makes me sad that all of this is swirling around, and I think as Jules Boykoff puts an asterisk on what otherwise would be an incredibly stellar career and a world historic career. It's unfortunate.
I see this as
a, you know, somewhat heartbroken fan as well, you know, of the Albiceleste. Like, you know, for me, in previous World Cups, Argentina has been not the nation of, you know, racism and belligerence, and but the nation of Violeta Parra,
that's true.
Of Mercedes
right.
Sosa,
right, or of the teacher, you know, of the teachers' Zanon, union, remember,
Madres de Plaza de Mayo,
right,
you know,
right, and so, remember they even did a banner with unions when they were in the economic crisis back a few years ago, their national team. But hey, we are short on time right. to get to everything we got to do, and I just wanted to finish the thing about Messi too is, of course, one of the sad things per your point is Barcelona, of course, which he was so wrapped up for so much of his career, was always has always been a progressive political force. Catalonian independence, but internationalism, et cetera. Now, I wanted to throw this out too.
And because, indeed, that baby picture was a project of
right,
UNICEF
there we
when
go.
They were sponsored by UNICEF.
Absolutely. Look, Maradona versus Messi, and I want to throw this out now and just let's not talk about it. Let's go to Galloway after this because just to chew on it, though, for people and to get it, there's a discussion of the greatest player of all time. And, you know, Pele, the people in the dialogue tend to be, you know, Pele, Maradona, Messi, Ronaldo, not as much as he was a few weeks ago, and sometimes Johan Cruyff. Leave Cruyff aside because he really only gets.
What about Ronaldo Nazario?
No. These are
no?
come on. No, okay. Seriously, these are the five who get mentioned in contemporary discussion. Okay, and Messi and Maradona right now seem to have been lifted up. And here's the thing: Bill James, the great baseball historian, constructed a way to approach comparing people across generations, and he also did this. He spoke about the peak 5 years of their career. And the total career effect. I think Messi, with longevity, has surpassed Ronaldo. Look, Pele, Cruyff, and Maradona did not have careers this long. To be so spectacular for 20 years has been completely unparalleled for both players, but Messi definitely has now has pulled himself considerably above Ronaldo. He gets that prize now. As of right now, and especially if he wins Vegas, but nothing compares to the top 5 years of Diego Maradona. Because he not only won in 86, he took his team to the final in 90, almost single-handedly in both cases with Argentina, but nothing in Messi's CV matches what he did with Napoli in the by far the best club, the club league in the world, by far the best league. At the very time that the Milan team of 88 and 89 was considered probably the best team at that time of all time of any club side, he wins two Serie A titles, a European trophy on a team that was crap when he came to it, and he overcame the best club teams. That is the top, per Bill James, the baseball historian, that is the top five-year period of any soccer player in history. And go back and watch Maradona as a leader of people and everything, too. It is above what you see with Messi. So let's now go to George Galloway, controversial British politician, opining on why Argentina is so toxic right now.
I did mention on Wednesday that I'm involved in an investigation into FIFA of such dramatic and sordid proportions that when I was first given the story, I could scarcely credit it. And I'll be working on that. It may take a few weeks to bring it out, but bring it out I shall. But I never imagined that I'd be pushing at a door so wide open as the door for attacking FIFA now is. I don't know who's going to win the World Cup, and I don't really have a favourite left in the competition, as long as it's not Argentina. Now, don't get me wrong, the country that produced Che Guevara and Diego Maradona and Alicia Castro and many, many other fine, radical and revolutionary people are friends of mine. And in times gone by, I would have been rooting for Argentina. But thanks to FIFA, Argentina are now on the brink, unless England beat them. What a dilemma that one for me. Unless England defeat them, Argentina are on the brink of being handed a rigged World Cup. A World Cup scarred with scandal and deliberately engineered controversy, which started with allocating the World Cup to the United States of America in the first place. This broken society, this society which breaks the societies of others, which denies visas to participants in the World Cup, which disallowed the Iranian team from even staying in the United States for a couple of hours after their game to warm down, made them leave immediately for Mexico and the wonderful Mexican people. Referees that have, in broad daylight, robbed Senegal, robbed Egypt, robbed Switzerland. This World Cup is such a spectacular scandal that when my story about corruption in FIFA breaks, everyone in the world will be applauding.
Well, again, we don't know if we'll see that from George Galloway. But, you know, here's the thing, though. Of all the things that have been spoken about with Argentina, one that doesn't get highlighted much, and Galloway didn't mention, but he did make the connection between the USA and why that could also fuel the corruption. Leo Messi, of course, plays for the MLS. And so you can imagine they want to see Messi win because it will be such a coup for this, you know, obviously second-tier league with a lot of money behind it, but second-tier league in the United States to have the best player in the world. And I do think he's going to win the best player of the tournament and probably deserves it. I mean, they do pull through in the final 15 minutes. But it's so funny when he says, against Switzerland, the home of FIFA. So the drive for Argentinian corruption is so great that it's even messing up the home country of FIFA. But, hey, Mel, so what we should do now is remind people again is that we have this project globally, and the people's game is right at the heart of it, to show a red card to Donald Trump when he gives out the trophy to the winner. And document yourself doing it and then put it online. And I am going to give a quote from someone I've been working on this in a moment. But what we're going to do now is we're going to first play the final clip we're going to go to, who's a great candidate out in the Central Valley for Congress, Randy Villegas. And he talks about what soccer means to his communities out there. And we're going to hear from Randy. And we're going to come back. We're going to have the quote from Congresswoman Ana Lila Mejia, who I've worked with over the past week on this project of getting red cards. She is on site right now. They're handing out 40,000 red cards, and it's going brilliantly. I'll read a quote from her, and we'll maybe try to figure out what the best hashtag might be for hashtag red card. Because the thing is, if you're not at the game, also if you are at the game, if anybody's listening who's at the game right now, make sure you document it if you're at the game, because FIFA controls the broadcast feed. They're unlikely to show 40,000 people holding up red cards when Trump is giving out that trophy. That's how many red cards this project's distributing, and there'll probably be even more there. But let's now hear from Randy Villegas, and we'll be right back. Hello, Alan here, and I'm here with Randy Villegas, who is running for the U.S. Congress in California's 22nd district. He is in the runoff, given California's so-called jungle primary system, and he is the Democrat running against an incumbent Republic, but in a redrawn district in which Randy has a great shot of entering Congress in January, which is thrilling. So, Randy, what are your thoughts about the 2026 World Cup? And just for the record, we're talking in between the semifinals and the finals.
Yeah, really excited. I think we've seen so much energy. I mean, I still trip out at seeing the photo of Messi and Emil. It's crazy, right? That what a coincidence, and now they're going to be in the final together. But I think it's also reflecting, you know, thinking about the politics of just like how these teams are built up, and specifically, like, you know, the teams that I was rooting for mainly was Mexico and the United States, and, you know, it was sad to see them both eliminated. But, you know, one thing that I saw Mexico do in the immediate aftermath was how President Sheinbaum is now talking about actually investing into academies and youth and building up talent, and how we're still stuck in this pay-to-play system in the United States where we have so much talent that's trapped in poverty, where if you can't afford to pay, you know, $10,000, $15,000 a season, you know, we might not be finding the best talent that we have here in the United States. And so I think we should look to what other countries are doing, whether that's Norway, whether that's Mexico, to really build up our talent to the best of our ability. But, you know, I grew up playing soccer. You know, I played in what we call the Mexican League, where it was, you know, cheap. We had to pay ref fees every game, but, you know, I could play a season with my friends. And we need to be building those opportunities. I love how, you know, Zoran Mamdani has opened up 24-hour spaces for soccer. Like, that is incredible. It's a people's game. It's a people's sport. And I would just love to see us take it as seriously as other countries in terms of investing in our youth.
Well, thank you so much, Randy Villegas. And check out his campaign, Randy Villegas, yep, running for the U.S. Congress in the 22nd district.
Yeah,
22nd district in California.
Check out Randy.vote to help us win.
Thank you.
And Mel, so there's Randy Villegas. So, like, you know, let's do this. Why don't your final thoughts in a second be about who you think is going to win this match? And then
But now your final thoughts before those final thoughts, more generalized about the tournament. And then we'll come back to me and I'll read the quote from the congressperson, go back to encouraging people to get their own red cards and show them to the world today. And then you'll do your pick. I'll do my pick and we'll be out until next Friday.
Okay. Well, this, you know, this red card campaign, I think, if it's successful, will be, I hope, a really good catalyst to, I think, a fight that is especially relevant now to get global football back in the hands of the people, as Jules Boykoff said earlier. You know, he's got his reboot FIFA thing going on. You know, we've got this red card thing going on. And I believe that, you know, especially as people in the United States get hip to the global game and start, you know, becoming a part of this global community, I think it is especially incumbent on us as, you know, relative or the U.S. as relative newcomers to this tradition, to help and you know, throw our weight behind the rest of the world to say this is the people's game. We will reclaim this from the hands of the oligarchs and start to dream and imagine what a global spectacle and a global football is for us. I don't know if you want my thoughts on the game and the tournament.
No, I promised, of course, the Congresswoman, I'm going to read her statement. And she was out here this week, and we discovered we're working on the same idea. You know, I announced on the David Goldblatt interview at the end of that back on a week ago today that, you know, I really thought that people should show the red card to Trump during the trophy ceremony. And it turned out that this is a project that has been being developed by people in New Jersey. And I've been working with them and getting the word out today across media. And you can see my article on the People's Game website at thepeoplesgame.org. It's at the top of the peoplesgame.org website. And it is called, "It is Time to Give Trump a Red Card." And here now is the quote from, I'll get it for you right now, from it's so funny. I go to my texts and people are sending me things about what I'm saying live, right? So here it is from Representative Annalilia Mejia, who's just a fantastic rep. She's a career organizer. She's bringing that spirit to Congress, and she's bringing that spirit to the World Cup final. She was elected in a special election to replace Representative Mikey Sherrill when Mikey Sherrill was elected governor. And so there was an open seat, and she is already in Congress, and she's already won her primary to complete a full term for next time in a predominantly Democratic district. Not overwhelmingly, but predominantly. Great candidate. Keep an eye on her. Fantastic organizer. So here's what she says. Rep. Annalilia Mejia, "The eyes of the world are on the World Cup. It should be a celebration of the beautiful game, a moment that brings people together across borders and cultures. But Donald Trump is going to try to make it about himself. Instead, we're here to send a different message. Donald Trump has spent his presidency acting as if the rules don't apply to him. Whether it's abusing the power of his office, undermining our democracy, or interfering in the World Cup, where he doesn't belong, it's always the same pattern. The game only works when everyone plays by the same rules. Democracy only works the same way. That's why we're handing out a red card today. This is a peaceful reminder that no one, not even Donald Trump, not even the president, is above the rules." And there we go. That's from Rep. Annalilia Mejia. Check out their project, finalredcard.com. Check out the article I wrote at the peoplesgames.org. Mel, your final thoughts on who's going to win today, the tournament. Quickly, you got about a minute, and then I'll have 15 seconds.
Great. 90% of the world is pulling for Spain right now, apparently. Wow. But we cannot, and, you know, that would be very spectacular if they were able to topple the defending world champions. We can't, however, cut out the dark arts of the Argentinian team. I will say, though, that we do have a very real possibility that in terms of the player of the tournament, the last word could actually belong to France, as Mbappe yesterday in that kind of spectacular little bit of woulda, coulda, shoulda game between England and France. Mbappe not only is now in the lead by 2 goals for the Golden Boot, he also beat Messi's record for all-time World Cup goals, and he's just at the middle of his career versus Messi at the end. So, you know, the last word could indeed belong to Mbappe.
You did not, dare I say, predict the winner. So you go first, Mel.
I'm going to say Spain.
I myself am also going to say Spain. And we will be back for one more People's Game show here on KPFK. And Susie Weissman really is going to be back next week on this show here on Sunday. And so this is our last installment of the People's Game here at this hour. Again, we'll be having a wrap-up show on Friday this week at 5 p.m. This is the People's Game. Check out the website, peoplesgame.org. Get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And Melissa Figueroa, thank you so much as always.
Thank you, Ellen.
And I want to thank our guest today, Jules Boykoff. Of course, we heard clips from George Galloway. We heard a quote from Ana Lilia Mejia, and we heard a clip from Randy Villegas. Melissa Figueroa and Fernando Romero are my co-hosts and co-producers on The People's Game. And enjoy the game, which kicks off in an hour.
In a world filled with corporate media, predictable